Welcome to Dispatches, a short-form podcast from the old front line, and me, military historian Paul Reed. In these shorter podcasts, we'll tell some of the quieter, smaller stories of the Great War. We'll share books, look at original documents, and take dispatches on the road and visit locations across that landscape of the Great War. As November crept towards December in 1916, the Battle of the Somme had ended, but the weather turned progressively worse. From the autumn rains to the biting cold, and then snow, as the battle ended in places like Desire Trench north of Courcelet, or along the old Roman road close to the Butte de Warlencourt. In those final days in the approach to Christmas that year, British soldiers in the front line on the heights above the Ancre Valley brushed snow away from their trench periscopes as they stared out into a frozen no-man's land, a picture of hell tinged with frost. This was the second winter on the Somme for British troops, and in the 12 months since the last one, in the quieter times of 1915, a major battle had been fought here, a defining battle of the Great War, the Battle of the Somme. These men in those frost-filled frontline trenches were on ground that a year before had been occupied by the Germans, had been behind their forward zone of the battlefield. Germans had come and gone, taken rations up and the post, and marched out through here for rest behind the front line. And now this was the crater zone. And that battle that had brought them all to this point had cost for Britain and its empire over 150,000 dead in 1916, and it had brought with it a Pyrrhic victory and brought them now to the coldest winter of the war, where temperatures were reported to be below minus 20 in the front lines. But if we take a few steps back first, what had brought Britain and her empire to these vast open fields of the Somme? The Somme front in 1914 had been a place where France and Germany had clashed. As the Germans pushed hard on Paris as part of the Schlieffen Plan, German units moved up into the northern area of Paris, up into northern France, and clashed with French forces in so many places across Picardy. And in the ground around towns like Bapaume and Peronne, the French fought the Germans there. They were pushed back towards Albert, and in all those small little villages in that summer, late summer of 1914, French soldiers fought men in field grey right across that ground. This led to both sides digging in when the stalemates following the race to the sea, when the Germans moved even more forces up into northern France to try and get to the Channel coast, ended in failure. The Germans, realising that for now they were going no further, they dug in, not just there, but along all 450 miles of what became the Western Front. And the Somme area that we know so well with its connection to those battles of 1916 became a place where Frenchmen faced Germans in trenches across that chalk downland. It wasn't as much of a quiet sector as we often believe. There were battles there in 1914 following the establishment of the trenches, and then even bigger ones in 1915 with the Battle of Serre-Hébuterne in June of that year, for example. All of these covered in the excellent books, the Battleground Europe books by the late Dave O'Mara. But 1915 was a turning point in the war in so many ways. It saw the Allied attempt to try and break the German line with a whole series of offensives, and for Britain and its empire, the extension of their front just beyond Flanders and a bit of northern France down to a much wider area. And British troops began to arrive on the Somme front in the summer of 1915, a year before the Great Battle here, and take over positions from the French. Scottish troops of the 51st Highland Division taking over La Boisselle, for example. Trenches with unpronounceable French names were given new names, and the men gradually acclimatised to the conditions here. and new divisions part of that vast Kitchener's army that had been formed in 1914, having gone through their training, were now ready to be committed to the battlefield. And that summer of 1915 saw several of those arrive in France, and one of them head down to the Somme to get prepared for what might happen there in the months to come. The Somme for them was an ideal location because it was a quiet part of the line. Units were sent to these quiet sectors to acclimatise to trench warfare. And that unit that came across in that summer of 1915, part of Kitchener's army, that would go on to spend two Christmases on the Somme, was the 18th Eastern Division. The 18th Eastern Division, part of Kitchener's army, was essentially a home counties division. It was called an Eastern Division because the British Army was broken up into command areas where groups of regiments were brought together to operate under the same record office so that their records and papers could all be administered by one central office, essentially. So when we look at those regiments that made up that 18th Eastern Division, we see a commonality in geography with them, a kind of regional division made up from that wider kind of home counties area. So we've got the East Surrey Regiment has a battalion in there, the Queen's Royal West Surrey Regiment, the Norfolk Regiment, the Suffolk Regiment, the Essex Regiment, the Royal Berkshire Regiment, the Middlesex Regiment, the Royal West Kents, the East Kents, the Buffs, and the Royal Sussex provides the Pioneer Battalion. So you can see the kind of geographic location that the regiments within that division are drawn from, and that's reflected in the kind of men that join these battalions. And I interviewed quite a few veterans that served in this division at different points, and they were essentially, they weren't POWs battalions, but they were locally recruited. The 7th Royal West Kent, for example, kind of recruited in an area where Kent met the outer London suburbs. But it was a division that had had nearly a full year's worth of training, and it had a good commander, Sir Ivor Maxey. And following its arrival in France in July and August of 1915, its troops assembled, made their way down to the Somme front, and took over trenches in the southern sector of the Somme area. A lot of them, for example, holding the line close to Fricourt on that high ground above the village of the Bois Français. But now, after several months in those forward positions, the division, used to the day-to-day activities of trench warfare, was now moving towards a winter. And as Christmas approached, the units of the division moved into what was called the Tambour sector at Fricourt. This was west of the village of Fricourt. The Tambour, or the Drum, was a series of German trenches in that area where there was a lot of mining activity. The French had mined the Germans had mined the French, and now the British were here. Their tunnelling companies, recently formed tunnelling companies of the Royal Engineers, were operating under this sector too, as well as units, infantry units, being in the front line in the trenches, obviously on the surface. And this strange underground war that the men, the British soldiers who were here, were also becoming acclimatised to, was something that was resulting in craters not on the size of Hawthorne Ridge or Lochnagar, fairly small mine craters. You can see some of them at the Tambour position at Fricourt even to this day. These were several thousand pounds, or sometimes hundreds of pounds, of explosive used to take on specific targets or even try to demolish the tunnels of the other side by blowing what was called a camouflage that would explode underground with the charge going sideways rather than upwards to try and cave in the tunnels being used by the enemy's tunnellers. But that was the war underground, and the PBI up there in the trenches knew that with all this tunnelling going on, there could be an explosion that would result in the formation of a crater that could cave in, destroy their trenches, and kill or wound many of their men. And that had happened on the 23rd of December 1915, when the Germans had blown some mines here at the Tambour, resulting in some losses from the battalions of this division that were holding the line here at that time. On Christmas Eve, the men were anxious that this would happen again, but despite shelling, the Germans were largely quiet. The weather was now getting colder, dropping below 10 degrees in the morning of the 25th, Christmas Day, and later as low as 1 degree as the sun dropped. A year later, in that cold winter of 1916, men would have wished for temperatures like this, but these were soldiers only recently arrived in France, recently coming to terms that they were no longer civilians and now soldiers and living in open ditches on a battlefield, and this would have seemed very cold to them indeed. The 7th Battalion, the Queen's, in the front line at the Tambour, found the trenches here were in poor condition when they took them over. Many of these formerly French trenches had been poorly constructed and poorly maintained, and the British Army, who arrived on the Somme in 1915, had to do a lot of work to try and make that good. And at midnight on the 24th, 25th, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, the 7th Queen's were issued with new maps of this sector, finally showing the kind of detail that they needed to understand what their sector actually was. And again, this was a problem at this stage, is that trench mapping was still in its infancy. There were a lot of hand-drawn maps, and the exact area that you were taking over and where your trenches were, where the wire was, where machine guns were, where the enemy was often not directly apparent. And sometimes some of the most basic kind of intelligence information you think a unit would need was often lacking. The army massively increased in size and faced with this huge siege war on a massive scale was still coming to terms with that in many ways. The 7th Queen's observed that the Germans were looking over their parapets on Christmas Day, and one man was seen to be waving his Feldmützer, his cap, in the air, visibly towards the Tommies. So rather than go out into no man's land and instigate a truce as had happened a year before, these men possibly had only the vaguest awareness of that truce. It wasn't as famous then as it later became. Instead, they brought up snipers, and those snipers engaged these Germans who were making themselves targets, and one German soldier was seen to be shot and fall back into the trenches. It was a great contrast, really, to what had happened a year before. The war had moved on. There'd been so much killing all across the Western Front in 1915 that I don't think many people really had the stomach for a truce in 1915. Later at 7 a.m. on Christmas morning, the Germans were heard to be singing, most likely Christmas carols, and they shouted across no man's land, "Don't shoot!" Those British soldiers of the 18th Eastern Division responded with rifle fire and noted that no notice was taken of this request. The Germans, probably having given up on the idea of any kind of fraternisation with their enemy, later sent over trench mortar rounds into the British positions, and the gunners of the Royal Field Artillery from the 18th Eastern Division, who had their gun sights in nearby Becordel, responded with their 18-pounders. A fighting patrol was then taken out to inspect the German wire on Christmas Day. I suspect volunteers for that one might have not been particularly forthcoming, but they found a listening post and returned to report that without any kind of loss, probably with great relief to the officer who was given the task of taking them out that day. The rest of Christmas Day was just trench routine, holding the line, doing no doubt more digging than fighting. Trenches needed constant repair, and that was a soldier's task. And in the cold conditions that day, I think men would have been only too willing to pick up a shovel or a pick or whatever implement was required to do some donkey work rather than just sit there and freeze. And part of that trench routine was obviously to receive their regular rations of the day, which came forward with carrying parties. The battalion cookers, if they were any good, the men in charge of the battalion's food would obviously try and make a bit of an effort on Christmas Day as much as that was possible with men in the front line. And being in the front line, stand to in the morning, there would have been a rum ration. But this was no time, no place to be celebrating. The only kind of light relief that soldiers would have got in the front line on a day like that was to receive post from home. And post being pretty regular, with millions of letters going to and from the Western Front on a regular basis, men would have received Christmas cards and letters and parcels from the family, which through the post corporal and the post section within the battalion would have arrived in that forward area to be distributed to the men. That key aspect of keeping soldiers' morale up by receiving posts from home was an essential part of their frontline experience, particularly on days like this, when the old world and family back home must have felt a long, long way away. So that was the men in the front line. The division, with nearly 20,000 personnel, was not occupying the whole of the front line with every single man in the division in the forward zone of the battlefield. Units were out of the line, and one of those was the 10th Battalion of the Essex Regiment. Now, they subsequently had a very good old comrades association, and they published an excellent battalion history called With the 10th Essex in France, written by two of its officers, Banks and Chill. It's one of my favourite little battalion histories, and I have an original copy of it, which I can see just on the bookshelves just over there, that was owned by the family of Lieutenant Beaver, who was an officer of the battalion who was killed in the Ancre Valley in 1917 and is buried at Adenac Cemetery, and some of his original letters are tucked into that copy. It's been reprinted and available from Naval and Military Press, for example, and it's a good battalion history to understand what a battalion's experience of the Great War was all about. While some units of the 18th Eastern Division were in the front line, most of the battalions were out on rest near or in the town of Corby. This was a town in the Somme Valley behind Albert. It was surrounded by small little villages and suburbs, and the 10th Essex were in one of those suburbs at La Nouvelle after having just been in the line at La Boisselle and been involved in mining operations there where they'd lost some of their soldiers. The battalion history relates the accounts of what happened, what was their experience on Christmas Day 1915, that first Christmas on the Somme for British troops. Training simply hastened on Christmas, and when we slackened off a day or two before the feast, we had our work cut out to get our Christmas shopping done in time. Corby can seldom have been so gay or prosperous, and the good folk who kept the shops in the street running south from the cathedral never failed us. They had fruit and nuts and decorations galore. The beer, too, was plentiful, and not at all bad. By the aid of the mess cart and a limber or two, we had our Christmas fare at the dining hall by Christmas Eve. The girls' school at La Nouvelle made an excellent dining room and concert hall, and everyone helped to make it gay and jolly. Few of us had experienced Christmas in a Roman Catholic country before, and during the afternoon of Christmas Eve, a fair number of requests were received for permission to attend the midnight mass. Many men attended this service with their hosts. Christmas Day itself was fine, and the band roused us to Christmas pitch with a few carols ere it took us off to church parade. After service, it played from the bandstand in the square. La Place became quite a rotten row for the next hour, and then it marched home to the tune of "What cheer, me old brown son, how are you?" One's memory can still hear the shouts of the old battalion as that favourite tune came on. Dinners should have been cooked at 1 o'clock, but a minor tragedy occurred. There was one evil spirit in Corby, and he was the La Nouvelle baker. Days before, this gentleman had promised the colonel that he would roast pork for the whole battalion on Christmas morning. Normally he finished baking bread at 10 a.m, but during those days before Christmas, we all had shown such a liking for his bread that he put on 2 extra bakings daily. At 10:30 on Christmas Day, he quietly but firmly told the colonel that he couldn't start on the pork till 3 p.m. If he had only had the decency to give us a day's notice of this change of mind, what were we to do? I well remember being dragged in to reason with him in the best French I could muster. He was obdurate. We had to decide whether our company should wait till 5 or 6 p.m. for a roast or take stew at 2:30. We decided on the latter course and made the best of it. A plentiful supply of good pudding and other Christmas fare, and above all, an unlimited supply of cheery spirit, went a long way towards soothing things over. But it is impossible to neutralise the disappointment of dishing up another dose of everlasting stew in place of roast pork on a Christmas day on active service. For these men, so vividly described there by Banks and Chell in that history of the 10th Essex, it was a moment of peace, that Christmas of 1915, a moment of normality that perhaps they would look back on in the year ahead as their war took them through battles from the 1st of July, Troneswood, to the Thiepval Ridge and the high ground above Courcelette alongside the Canadians. The officers doubly celebrated by having their photograph taken in a group at a studio at a house outside La Nouvelle near to the railway station. This small chateau had been taken over by a local photographer and used as a place where soldiers could have their photographs taken, and many of the units had group photographs taken there on the back steps of the chateau. I first came across this chateau in that photograph of the men of the 9th Battalion King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, the men who coined that famous phrase, "when the barrage lifts." And through researching that photograph, discovered the story of this chateau, discovered that it had been used as a studio, and tracked it down. It's still there to this day. And since I picked up that first postcard taken there of the 9th Coyley, I've found many, many others. And in the history of the 10th Essex, there is one such photograph showing them on those steps, the little balustrade that surrounds the back of the chateau. I wonder how many thousands of British soldiers had their photographs taken there in that year leading up to the Battle of the Somme. Being close to a railway station, an area of movement of soldiers, I guess there was an almost never-ending supply of customers to that photographer. When I first went to the chateau, I did have the vain hope that I might find his archives tucked away in the loft, but it's used as social housing, and I suspect those glass plates have long since ceased to exist. So that was Christmas 1915 for the men of the 18th Eastern Division, some of them in the front line, anxiously waiting the explosion of enemy mines, patrolling in no man's land, living in the cold of the battlefield, and others like the 10th Essex having a Christmas dinner in a town amongst French people. A year on, the Christmas experience was very different. The whole of the 18th Eastern Division was out of the line this time. They weren't in the forward trenches. They were on rest at Abbeville after taking part in the final Somme assault at Desire Trench on the 18th of November 1916, when they'd fought alongside the Canadians. Being out of the line was most welcome, but swallowed, of course, with a bitter pill, the loss of their much-loved and respected divisional commander, General Maxey. Sir Ivor Maxey had not been killed, of course. He was such a good divisional commander that he'd now been promoted to corps commander, and he was leaving the division that he'd led from those early months in the front line through that first Christmas and on into those momentous battles of 1916. Having been promoted to take command of a corps because of his success in commanding these men, those men who had now lived through that hardest of years felt that somehow part of them was lost with his departure. He hadn't just been a good commander, but a lucky one, it seemed, and soldiers prize luck amongst all other things, especially at Christmas. In their warm billets, away from the war with the thunder of bombardments far in the distance, far away from that frozen battlefield around the Onc, they sung and they drank and they ate and they forgot the war for a while as the Christmas post caught up with them. In the warm billets of the farms that they occupied in those villages around Abbeville, the replacements, the men who joined after that most recent show, looked at them with envy as they heard the old hands tell the tales of 1916. As yet, they hadn't found their pathways across the battlefields. But in the year to come, with Arras and the mud of Passchendaele, they too would find their own identity as veterans, their own secret places that would never leave them. Their shadows of the old front line. You've been listening to Dispatches, part of the Old Front Line podcast, with me, military historian Paul Reed. If you've enjoyed this episode, please think about leaving a review on your favourite podcast platform, giving us a rating, and leaving a comment on the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, and if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/oldfrontline, or buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Thanks for listening, and see you again soon.